Vaccine to be free as rollout plans get go-ahead is the front page headline for the Irish Examiner this morning, above detail of the story that as the country prepares to start vaccinations next month, Taoiseach Micheál Martin has said the jabs will be free. The paper writes that the Taoiseach told last night's meeting of the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party that the vaccines will be made available in a sequence, with priority given to healthcare workers, the elderly and nursing home residents. The front page of the Irish News has the story that seven COVID-19 vaccination centres are to open in Northern Ireland, which will be receiving 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, 25,000 of which are due to arrive next week. On page 3 of the Irish Times, Paul Cullen has a helpful explainer panel which addresses many of the questions that are on everybody's lips, including, can we get back to normal soon? Not quite, he writes. It takes a month after the first of the two doses before Pfizer's jab is effective. The process of rolling out the vaccine to most of the population will take much of 2021. Still though, the vaccine story brought out the best in the tabloid headline writers this morning. The Irish Daily Star has fun rebranding the traditional Coca-Cola truck as Pfizer for its front page image, alongside the words "Jolly days are coming," while the Irish Sun leads on "Vac to the future." Surge in house prices to be fuelled by pandemic savings is the main front page story for the Irish Independent this morning, above Senan Maloney and Gareth Morgan's piece, which says that property prices are set to rise further since prospective buyers have been able to save more during the pandemic, with Irish people now holding €123 billion on deposit. Elsewhere, Owen English writes on the front page of The Examiner that the campaigner and historian Catherine Corliss fears that Cork's Bessborough site hides horrors similar to the Tuam Babies scandal. Ms Corliss spoke to The Examiner following confirmation that a property developer plans to build over 200 apartments on a parcel of land near the former mother and baby home, which campaigners believe overlaps a children's burial plot. Finally, the features pages of the Irish Times offer a truly eclectic mix of reading across pages 10 and 11. In Arts and Ideas, Tara Brady writes about Marion Davies, an early Hollywood star who became ridiculed because of her relationship with William Randolph Hearst. Jo Humphreys has a piece about Hannah Arendt, the political theorist who famously wrote of the banality of evil in her coverage of the trial of the Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann. In the Life Science section on page 10, UCD Maths Professor Peter Lynch has timely advice on aesthetic balance when it comes to Christmas tree decorating by employing the four-colour theorem. And Anthony King writes about the latest book from Harvard Professor Daniel Lieberman, which says that humans were evolved to run but not to exercise, good and all as it may be for us. He writes, when people don't exercise, we label them as lazy, but they're actually doing what we are evolved to do, which is to avoid unnecessary physical activity.
COVID-19 vaccine is likely to be available from early in the new year if it's approved by the European Medicines Agency later this month. Last night, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin told a meeting of the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party that the vaccine would be administered for free. However, the Taoiseach, the Leo Varadkar, is reported to have struck a more cautious note at the Fine Gael parliamentary meeting, saying there were a number of unknowns, including possible rare side effects. For more, let's talk to Mary Regan of our political staff. Mary, after yesterday's announcement in London, which means the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is likely to be available in the north from next week, the focus has turned to the likely timescale in the south. What can you tell us?
Yeah, well, here we're still really awaiting the nod from the European Medicines Agency. They are expected to give their assessment on the Pfizer vaccine by December 29th and the Moderna one by January 12th. So there is a lag, I suppose, between what's happening in the UK and what's happening to likely to happen in the US over the next week and what's happening in Europe. But of course, the EU has defended this more cautious approach, saying it's the most effective regulatory mechanism that it's going ahead with now. And the Taoiseach yesterday in the Dáil said we shouldn't in any way create a pressure zone on the regulatory authorities. So he's really calling for some patience. And after that, really, it will be around within 10 days of the approval, it's likely that some vaccines could be administered here. Now, NPHET will discuss today who should be prioritised, but the Taoiseach did say at his Fine Gael parliamentary party meeting last night that nursing home residents and staff, that healthcare staff and the elderly and high-risk groups will be prioritised in a sequenced approach, I suppose it's who gets it after that that's likely to cause, you know, some debate or difficulty. There's some discussion maybe around people in other frontline workers and people working in meat plants being prioritised next in the queue. Now, that will be decided by a memo to Cabinet next week. After that, there will be this report given to government from the expert group, and the task force has been looking at a whole range of issues. So, you know, one of them is where these vaccines might be administered. So, you know, will it be temporary vaccination centre facilities? You know, they might be in schools or universities, and also administering the vaccines in hospitals, GP surgeries, perhaps even pharmacies. So the Taoiseach did say in the Dáil yesterday that due to the scale of this, it's likely that more than just the normal workforce will be needed to administer it. But of course, where it's given is also important in terms of public buy-in and public trust. And on that, then there's the whole issue of the logistics, the storage and the IT infrastructure, because there will be need for some sort of surveillance, monitoring and interpretation of the data, you know, who has the vaccine, how it's working. And really, there is no such system really in place already in Ireland. You know, the only unique identification system we have in this country is the PPS number. So there's lots to be considered there. That is before they even get into a communications campaign to get public buy-in to this, which the parties agree is vital. So while the science of the vaccine is one thing, I think the politics of the vaccine is only just beginning, and that's also likely to be a complicated affair.
As you say, there are an awful lot of considerations. What did Micheál Martin say to his parliamentary party meeting last night, and what did Leo Varadkar say to his?
Yeah, well, if not often that either of these two party leaders have had good news going into their meetings of TD senators and MEPs, but the assessment from those present or dialing into both meetings last night was considered broadly to be very upbeat. The Taoiseach said that there is light at the end of the tunnel. That's something a lot of people have been waiting to hear. He said 2021 will be a very different year as we emerge from COVID. He gave some details about, you know, who would be prioritised for the vaccine, as I mentioned. He also did say to TDs that, you know, it will be rolled out to the country free of charge. Now, some in his party were raising fears about a return to lockdown in January. Some also raising concerns about the continued closure of many pubs, particularly from rural TDs, saying, you know, that gastropubs mightn't necessarily be an option in certain rural areas. But the Taoiseach did say that he believes there is broad public buy-in for the way restrictions have been eased, and there's broad public support for that. Over in the Fine Gael side, the Taoiseach said he was reasonably confident that a vaccine would start to be rolled out in January. And he said widespread population immunity would be achieved by September or October, but the vaccine would have a meaningful impact well before then. Now, he did caution that there were a number of unknowns in relation to the vaccine. Some of those unknowns that the health experts have already been speaking about. But, you know, some of those present at the meeting said Leo Varadkar had his doctor's hat on rather than his politician's hat on when he made those comments, and that they were keen to stress really that his assessment was very positive. And he did say that the safety profile of the vaccines is very good. And then the Taoiseach also stressed this need for a communications campaign to avoid hesitancy. And that is a concern, I think, for any party leaders once this vaccine starts to be rolled out.
Mary, thanks indeed for that. Mary Regan there of our political staff.
But let's talk about what it means for the world now. And I'm joined by Dr. Margaret Harris from the World Health Organization. And thank you very much for joining us this morning, Dr. Margaret Harris. We've waited so long. It's been such a long and grim year for so many people, such loss and suffering involved right across the world. Many people thinking the past 24 hours, is it all too good to be true? It's a huge break forward, but at the same time, is it being rushed?
Good morning, Anya. It's certainly some much wanted good news before Christmas. No, it hasn't been rushed. The reason why it hasn't been rushed is because the science that was needed had actually been done before this outbreak. Much of the knowledge came from SARS and from MERS. So as a race, we're actually getting pretty good at making the most of what we're learning. As for the sort of regulators, they too have been doing the work prior to actually seeing the final data. They were ready to review it very quickly. So all the things that in normal times take a long time because, you know, people have got meetings scheduled mm-hmm. 2 months in advance and they do things a lot more slowly have been sped up, but corners haven't been cut.
And now we're going to all become very familiar with supply chains and cold storage, because two vaccines in particular, the Pfizer BioNTech and the Moderna ones, they require to be kept at very, very, very low temperatures. So the challenges of distribution there.
Yes, indeed. And again, actually, this is something that we in the world have quite some experience of, because the Ebola vaccine that we've used in conflict zones in some very, very difficult parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo and in Guinea and in Sierra Leone, that also is one that has to be stored at minus 79. And I can tell you, having done it myself, it's not easy, but you can do it. You can set up that cold chain and you can make it work.
And again, problems we hadn't thought about, but again, I understand some of the batches, because they come in, I think, a couple of hundred altogether. So by the time you break those up, the problems of actually getting those physically injected into the arms of, say, the most vulnerable in nursing homes who may not be able to move or be in a remote area.
Well, yes, indeed. And again, this is where the real challenge is going to come, the logistics. You are so right to raise that. And I heard earlier talking about how you have a surveillance system. And these things are critical. Not only do you want to make sure they get into people's arms, you want to make sure they're followed up for the second dose, and you want to follow everybody to understand whether or not there are any rare side effects and in whom that might be occurring. So all these things, all that tremendous planning work that has started, everybody's been thinking about this for some time, but now there'll be a huge acceleration. So I think a lot of the people running your public health system aren't going to get much time off for Christmas.
No, probably not, and not for the immediate future either. The other question that's going to arise, again, our Taoiseach Leo Varadkar talking about it at his parliamentary party meeting last night, we're going to have to have good records on everybody who gets the vaccine. They have to be reliable records. The last thing you want is, you know, is a black market and fake vaccine passports.
Absolutely. And that is another thing to watch out very much. So, in fact, we have a whole team of people expert in looking at the counterfeit issue. And we do know with medicines, for instance, that that is a big concern. So that's exactly right. You need to have a good system tracking everything at every level, and also, as I said, following up every person who gets vaccinated if you can, to understand how well this is working and how well it works for people, and also to reassure you will always have a group of people who are very anxious and worry about receiving the vaccine. The more information we have about how it works in populations, the more helpful it is for the people who are anxious.
There's a double challenge, isn't there? There's persuading those who are reluctant, and there's also going to be the fight for making sure that, you know, people who want the vaccine, that it's distributed fairly. How big a challenge is that globally, do you think?
You've put it very well. Yes, you've got the sort of the early adopters, the people who rush in and want it at all costs, and also who don't understand that this is a two-dose, most of them will be two-dose regimes. So it's not like, oh, I've got the vaccine, everything's good. No, what matters is what's happening in your body. Do you have the antibodies that protect you from the virus? And we know that you need the second dose in many of these regimes to ensure that protection. So at all levels, and it's very important now, and you've been doing a tremendous job yourself getting that information out and helping ensuring that your listeners have all the information they need to be doing the things they need to do to protect their health. And lastly, I would say we have to keep on with the public health measures. The less virus there is in the community, the more effective the vaccine will be.
I notice even overnight, as this, you know, good news was being celebrated around the world, more people died in the United States of COVID-19 than died in 9/11. The head of their CDC warning things will get worse before they get better.
Well, indeed, because again, with the vaccination, yes, it will start to protect people, but that will be an immune barrier. We will not that will not stop the transmission of the virus for a long time unless we do all the really solid public health measures. So in honour of all those people, more than 1.4 million people, please, I say to everybody, please continue with the measures. They're boring, they're annoying, but they do work.
We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for talking to us. That's Dr. Margaret Harris from the World Health Organization.
And let's turn next to the talks on a post-Brexit trade deal between the EU and Britain, which might or might not be entering their final hours. Fishing rights still haven't been agreed, with the focus now on how much access EU boats will have to UK waters. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is on the line from Brussels. Tony, as far as fishing rights are concerned, what has changed?
Well, there are two fundamental issues when it comes to the fisheries negotiations, Rachel. One is what they call the quota share. So that's the share that each country gets of a particular species of fish. And the other fundamental demand of the EU is that European boats still get access to British waters to catch the fish. So you're talking about both quota share and access. Now, the big sort of scrap up until now has been over the quota share, you know, what percentage of the value of the fish that EU boats catch in British water would be handed back to the UK and how much could they keep. And roughly speaking, Michel Barnier has been looking for between 15 and 18% of the value of fish caught in British waters to be given back to the UK. The UK is looking for about 80%. Those talks are kind of parked, but what they've been looking at now is this idea of access, and Britain appears to be really emphasising this idea of taking control or taking back control of their waters and having much stricter constraints over who gets into to their waters to do the fishing. And there's a linkage now between access and having an annual negotiation over what's called the total allowable catch or the TAC. I mean, fishing communities will be familiar with these terms, but it's basically how much of your share can you catch depending on the science each year. And essentially, the UK seems to want to limit access to certain boats based on an annual negotiation. So in other words, each year you could be facing a denial of access to British waters, and that would obviously be a grave problem for European boats. And in response, the EU is saying, no, we need to have stability, we need to have predictability, and so that's where things are at there.
What about the other obstacles to agreement? Has any progress been made there?
Well, you hear of incremental progress in the other issues like the level playing field and governance, but again, no major breakthroughs on the question of the level playing field and state aid and so on. The UK appears to be reticent over what kind of powers its own competition regulator would have to constrain a British government in future from bailing out a particular company or a particular sector, whereas the EU wants to have fairly binding rules that would apply on both sides to make sure that neither side gets an unfair competitive advantage through state subsidies. Governance, the idea of how you resolve disputes, again, no real breakthrough there. The UK is resisting any idea that the EU could retaliate in one sector for a breach of the rules in another sector. So we're not really seeing any major breakthroughs there. And time, of course, is getting very short.
Yeah, we say that almost every time we speak, but it's true. If this is to be agreed and then ratified by the end of the year, they really don't have a lot of time.
Well, yeah, that's exactly true, Rachel. And funny, I mean, Michel Barnier, speaking to EU ambassadors yesterday, talked about the coming hours being vital, even that it was going to be needed. A deal had to happen within maybe 48 hours or something. But then member states are saying, look, why are we putting ourselves under the pressure of procedural considerations like the European Parliament ratifying and other formalities that have to be gone through? Why are we doing that in a way that might deliver a suboptimal deal? You know, why don't we push the formalities to the absolute limit to make sure we get the right kind of deal. And then we could be, again, talking about a potential provisional application of the treaty from the 1st of January, and then ratification might happen later. But again, as we've mentioned before, that opens up a whole other realm of complexities and legal and political difficulties.
Tony, as always, thank you for joining us this morning. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly.
Total business activity in Ireland's services sector economy fell at a faster rate in November than the previous month. That's according to the latest AIB PMI. Other indicators were more promising. New business declined only slightly, while the outlook for activity in 2021 strengthened amid vaccine hopes. One third of businesses in Ireland won't exist by 2025 without digital transformation. That is one of the findings of a survey carried out by tech company Explio. It found that the sectors worst equipped digitally are construction, education, hospitality, tourism and government. A new training programme has been launched to tackle low levels of employment among people with disabilities. Funded by the National Disability Authority, it hopes to support employers to become disability confident. The launch coincides with International Day of Persons with Disabilities. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 90.5 pence sterling and $1 21.2 cents.
And with the sport this morning, here's Des Cahill.
Yeah, good morning to you, Rachel. We're going to start with last night's Champions League action, and the Brazilian star Neymar scored twice as Paris Saint-Germain beat Manchester United 3-1 at Old Trafford. Neymar put the French side ahead after 6 minutes. United did draw level through Marcus Rashford, but PSG grabbed the win when Marquinhos poked home a goal in the 69th minute and Neymar added the third goal in stoppage time. United's difficulties intensified when their midfielder Fred was sent off for a second yellow card with 20 minutes left. The group couldn't be tighter. Going into the last game, United, PSG and Red Bull Leipzig are all on 9 points each heading into the final match. Leipzig were 4-3 winners in Istanbul. This was the post-match reaction of United manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
When you see the team sheets, you think there might be goals in this game because there's loads of attacking talent, and I don't think anyone were disappointed. Chances for both teams, and of course we, with a bit of more clinical finishing, we should have finished the game like midway in the second half, because I thought that period they were there for the taking. If Marquinhos had bigger studs on, he would have been offside. That's a marginal decision as well. So sometimes it's you can't really put your finger on what's the deciding factor. Today they were a lucky, not better team because they score. But I thought both teams played really well.
Elsewhere, striker Olivier Giroud scored 4 goals as Chelsea won 4-0 at Seville to secure top spot in their group with a match to spare. Dortmund and Lazio drew 1-1. Barcelona won 3-0 at Ferencvaros. Juventus striker Cristiano Ronaldo scored his 750th goal of a remarkable career in their 3-0 victory over Dynamo Kiev. And this was the game where Stephanie Frappard became the first female referee to take charge of a Champions League match. Now tonight, Dundalk are in action. Manager Filippo Giovanoli will pick the team for the game against Molde in Norway, despite Giovanoli being banned from acting as head coach of the game. He doesn't possess the relevant coaching qualifications. The club was issued with a €50,000 fine as a result of his shadow coaching in the early games of the group stages. So Shane Keegan will manage the sideline, and he's been talking about how Dundalk will approach tonight's game, given they have to play Shamrock Rovers in the FAI Cup final on Sunday evening.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a balancing act, Ari, that is for sure, and they are exactly the kind of conversations that we've had over the last couple of days. But I think we're absolutely capable of withdrawing a fella and replacing him with a fella arguably as good. Like, if you're, because he's sitting beside me, if you're taking Nathan off and putting on Daniel Kelly, or taking Daniel Kelly off and putting on Nathan, to me, you know, you're going from strong to strong there one way or another. I don't think you're really weakening your side in any way, shape or form. So I think we can make changes as the game progresses to try and keep players fresh, while also them potentially being the ideal change to make in terms of trying to get a result out of tomorrow night's game at the same time.
That's Shane Keegan. In rugby news, Andy Farrell will this afternoon name the Irish team to play Scotland on Saturday. It's expected that both Johnny Sexton and Robbie Henshaw will return as Ireland bid for third place in the Autumn Nations Cup. In Gaelic games, Owen Elliott of Antrim has been named as referee for the All-Ireland Senior Camogie Final between Galway and Kilkenny on Saturday week. And racing action today is in Clonmel, and the first race is off at 12:30 on.
Des, thank you for that. The UN says more needs to be done to make sure people with disabilities are not left behind after the COVID-19 pandemic. This marks International Day of Persons with Disabilities, which has a new significance this year given the extra challenges so many faced in 2020. Our social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally, visited St Paul's Centre for Children with Autism and Intellectual Disabilities. It's in Beaumont in Dublin, where, despite all the odds, they've managed to remain open and provide services throughout the pandemic.
If you've ever wondered what it's like for people staying in respite services, here's Alan Graham to explain his day.
Oh yeah, I had my breakfast, as usual, brushed my teeth and relax, and then...
Do you go to school?
Yes, of course, and go to school.
And what's your favourite subject?
Relaxing and going for drives and walks.
The 17-year-old who has autism knows what he likes.
I was wondering what the best food in respite is.
Oh, burgers, pizzas, carrots and stuff.
Dinners, including the carrots, were put on the tables of St Paul's Child and Family Centre respite services right throughout the pandemic. Here's its medical director, Dr Carol Cassidy.
We made a decision early on to continue the overnight respite for a small core number of children who had particularly high level of need. And then for the majority of children, we adapted how we deliver that respite service to a day respite model. So then when we reopened all of our respite houses in July, we continued to provide respite for one child per night at a time. And in that way, reducing the number of social contacts each person had, and keeping things safe for children and staff. It's all
he has. For parents like Lynn Rochford, whose son Peter has attended St Paul's since he was 5 years of age, the continuation of services throughout the pandemic has been invaluable.
Petey's 16 now and I have to be beside him every minute of the day. Like, that's his challenges, you know. I have to be beside him in the same room all day, and that day can start at 3 or 4 in the morning. So to have that respite, you just kind of go, not be on alert constantly. Like, just such a waiting list for respite, and there's plenty more families like me that need it, you know. That's, it's a necessity. Nobody sets out wanting respite, but, you know, it's a necessity. You need it to cope.
Peter has autism and a severe intellectual disability. He's physically big, he has two male carers, and he spends much of his school day outside because he's not fond of being indoors. He is very fond of Jean Cullerton, though.
Your kisses. Kisses.
Jean works in payroll and administration, and her office looks out over the playground where Peter spends much of his day.
I don't think it's me. I think it was just someone he could see. They'd bring him around to calm him, or if he was good, I'd give a balloon. I had no sign language, so it was his carers who were teaching me. And the kissing through the glass, if he was good, you know. So we're trying to train him now to clean the glass. That's the next step.
Originally set up by the Sisters of Mercy, St Paul's is 50 years in existence this year. 28 children attend the respite services and 54 go to the special school, which is run separately. Director of Service Claire Bow says everyone roped in to ensure that St Paul's could remain open this year.
Without the staff being here all of the time, being available, being open to work in a safe way, and really asking us as a management team, allow us to work in a safe way, allow us to continue delivering a service. That's how we've been able to do that, and it's really thanks to the staff that we have here.
Back at Respite, which is one of three houses run by St Paul's in Dublin 9, Alan says he's learned to live with COVID-19 and he's taking it in his stride.
This thing doesn't bother me at all because, like, I care, because we all have to stay safe. And besides, I'm used to staying at home, so it doesn't bother me and make a big deal for me. So, yeah, it's just a normal day, even though this thing's going on.
Just a normal day. 17-year-old Alan Graham ending that report from Alva Keneally.
Well, since the COVID-19 pandemic began, public health officials have repeatedly reminded us about staying safe. But is that really possible for people on low incomes who are living in shared rented accommodation with upwards of four people per bedroom? A report from the RTE Investigations Unit, to be broadcast tonight on Primetime, uncovers a number of locations where, in some cases, up to six people share cramped and overcrowded bedrooms. Barry O'Kelly from RTE Investigates joins us. Barry, bring us through the background to tonight's report, if you would.
Sure, Rachel. As part of our investigation, our undercover researcher visited five properties which were advertised online. One of the locations comprised of a single room which served as a bedroom, a kitchen, a sitting room, all for four people. This was just one of the locations, and our experts looked at footage from these visits, and they felt it raised concerns about the potential for transmission of coronavirus. Another location that we looked at, it was in a similar setting, except there was one difference. A tenant was being offered a bare mattress, which was taken down every night and placed on the floor, where it was sandwiched between a wall, a sofa and a washing machine. We also looked at more modern buildings, and each of those had a bedroom for up to six people. One of these places, a three-bedroom cottage, accommodated a total of 16 tenants. And that property was generating €5,006 per month. We hear now from Kevin Hollingsworth from the Institute of Chartered Surveyors, who looked at the footage.
And it looks like an unsafe environment. When you have over-occupancy such as this, it presents a real and serious danger to the well-being and health and safety of the occupants, more so than ever in our current COVID times.
This is it, Barry. It does sound really tough, and I thought it would be really hard to maintain your distance from somebody else. Are inspections being carried out?
Well, local councils enforce the housing standards, and national inspection figures, which we obtained for the programme, reveal that in the first 6 months of the year, three out of four properties which were inspected were deemed on a first inspection to be non-compliant with the housing standards. But by and large, these inspections rarely look at the issue of overcrowding, because this is not an issue which is covered in the national housing standards. And the specific legislation on overcrowding, which dates back to 1966, is considered outdated. Dublin City Council told us it hasn't used this legislation in over 10 years, and they have to rely instead on fire safety laws. In a statement, the council told us that the reason they didn't use the 1966 Housing Act on overcrowding was because of what they describe as it being cumbersome, slow, and penalties being minimal.
Barry, thanks indeed for that. Barry O'Kelly there from RTE Investigates.
Now, for most of us, the pandemic has made 2020 a pretty grim year, but there has been a silver lining of sorts from the pandemic for the Peter McVerry Trust, and their chief executive, Pat Doyle, is on the line. Good morning to you, Pat Doyle.
Good morning.
Talk to me about, I suppose, the weird way in which the pandemic has made life easier for the Peter McVerry Trust in terms of sourcing accommodation.
Well, I suppose this year has been a year like no other, and generally we're out there all the time trying to scout properties, engage landlords, but you know, heretofore the landlords have had a choice of who they partner with, and a lot of them would partner with corporates who need, you know, who'd be bringing in people into the cities, bringing people in from abroad, and they'd need to source accommodation for them. And also a lot of properties in the city, a lot of landlords would be holding them for a form of kind of short-term lettings or Airbnb type accommodation for tourism, both of which have kind of changed dramatically this year. Now tourism is shelved, and you know, international corporates are not bringing in people into the cities and into Ireland this year, and so landlords have you know, moved towards agencies like the Peter McVerry Trust for you know, for long-term investment, and that has made a huge difference, and that has allowed us to double the numbers of people of which we've been able to assist getting a key to the door to this year. So over 1,200 individuals, 850 units were secured by the Peter McVerry Trust up until the 1st of December this year. We'll probably top, you know, 1,300 individuals or 950 units by the end of the year.
And it's not just in big cities where people, of course, think of homelessness so much. It's counties around the country where you're now working. Talk to me more about that.
Yeah, well, I suppose we have. There's been some really good schemes brought in by the Department of Housing of late, and we're working very closely with the new minister and local authorities to access some of those schemes. And some of the new schemes have been revolutionary, really. One of them is a repair and lease scheme where we can talk to a landlord who has a property that hasn't been used because they haven't had the capital resource to bring that property into use. And we're talking about bringing properties in at appropriate standards, you know, in relation to your previous article there, which is shocking. So what we're saying on them schemes is we've been maximising those schemes around bringing back in disused properties. And that way we're not competing with first-time buyers, we're not competing with the markets. We're bringing back properties that heretofore have been lying idle, and everybody knows them in towns. There's another scheme that's come in that's been very useful in rural Ireland in particular, and the smaller towns and villages, is disused commercial units that have been disused for a number of years that are never going to reopen as a commercial because the footfall isn't there. And we've been converting them into residential units. So an old bank in Cork that, you know, as part of a restructuring will never open as a bank again, we're turning that into 5 units. An old barber's in Rush turned it into a 1-bedroom unit. 5 disused units in Kilbeggan, we've turned them into 9 1-bed units. So that's important in three areas. One is we're one of the leading providers of housing force in the country for taking rough sleepers off the streets and giving them their own accommodation, and they need a 1-bed, and there's a huge shortage of 1-beds. And so when we bring those units back, we're able to decide whether they're a 1-bed or a 2-bed or a 3-bed, and we're bringing them back as 1-beds. And so that's helping housing force roll out across the country. We're also then generating footfall in towns, breathing life back into towns, helping I never thought we'd be a friend to tidy towns, but we've become a friend to tidy towns. If you take a tie, for example, we took 5 derelict units in a tie that have been derelict for years, and tidy towns were painting the front of them and trying to make them look decent. We've brought them right back now. With those government schemes, with the department, we've been able to give people a key to the door and change their life, thank God, for good.
Pat Doyle, thank you for bringing us that good news this morning, and good luck with your work. Pat Doyle there, Chief Executive of the Peter McVerry Trust. And Jill Steadman has the business news.
Thanks, Anya. Potential home buyers have been largely unaffected by the economic impact of COVID-19, according to a new survey by myhome.ie. It found that 58% of potential home buyers have been able to save more money for a deposit since March. We can speak now to Angela Keegan, Managing Director of myhome.ie. Angela, sentiment regarding house prices has shifted significantly since the summer. Potential home buyers are now less hopeful that a significant price drop is on the way.
Yes, Jill, that's exactly what we're saying. When we surveyed after we were coming out of the first lockdown, almost 7 in 10 potential home buyers predicted that house prices would go down by more than 5%. In our recent survey, which we conducted towards the end of November, that number is down to 22%. So just over 2 in 10 potential buyers believe that house prices are going to go down by more than 5%. And I think the reality of the market is what they're experiencing, and that's what's helping them come to that conclusion.
And while people have managed to save more money and mortgage approvals reached a record high in October, housing supply is still the biggest issue for potential home buyers.
Absolutely. If you think of it, the market was practically on ice for 10 weeks during the first pandemic. And the impact of that has been that 14,000 less second-hand homes have come to the market this year. And even though we saw a pickup in activity when the lockdown ended, we didn't see a significant enough pickup to make up for that drop. And then when you combine that with the slowdown in construction of new builds last year, 21,000 would have come to the market. This year it's predicted to be around 16,000. So, you know, we have a lot less property available for sale. And then on the demand side, as you referenced, 58% of potential buyers have been able to save more. So we have buyers getting, mortgage approval earlier than potentially the predicted, but they're coming into a market where there is absolutely a huge shortage of supply.
The government has extended the Help to Buy scheme for first-time buyers, but the survey found that three-quarters of respondents think that the government could do more to help them get a home.
Yeah, 72% is the number, and that's remained consistent over the last three surveys, which surprised me because Minister O'Brien, as you referenced, certainly has extended the Help to Buy scheme and improved it up to 30,000 for those who qualify. I think, again, it's reflecting the reality of the market that, you know, potential buyers need help. We need more stock. And I think, you know, a number of schemes have been introduced to bring more property back onto the market. And it probably will take a while before the reality of the situation and the fact that there, you know, it'll be a little while before there will be some easing in stock. That'll need to happen before we'll see that number drop.
The pandemic has changed what people are looking for from a home, with a home office now top priority, not surprisingly.
Yes, we always ask, you know, what people are looking for, what features they're looking for. And typically we see garden, side entrance, garage, off-street parking. And this time, 46% of people cited a home office. So again, it's predicting the reality of living with COVID. You know, a lot of us are working from home and people are looking at how their lives will change in the future and what they're going to need from their home in the future, because, you know, over the last number of months, you know, home has never meant as much as it has done during this pandemic.
Okay, Angela Keegan, Managing Director of MyHome.ie, thanks for joining us. That's the business news for now. I'll have more at 8:30.
Well, it's a cold outlook now with a nationwide weather advisory out for the next couple of days. And we've got a status yellow snow ice warning in effect for Donegal today, where most of the wintry showers will present in the short term. So bitterly cold out there today with a plunge of Arctic air, further widespread heavy showers early on. Some of those will be wintry with isolated thunderstorms. Now those showers will gradually become confined to Atlantic counties, with spells of winter sunshine developing elsewhere. Highest temperatures today of just 2 to 5 degrees, all in light to moderate west to northwest breezes. Now it's going to be very cold tonight with a widespread sharp to severe frost. Overall dry with long clear spells, but a few wintry showers will persist closer to the Atlantic. Snowfall mainly over higher ground here. Lowest temperatures of 0 to minus 3 degrees in light northwest breezes. Now that's going to take us into a widespread frosty start to tomorrow Friday with icy stretches. Whilst many areas will actually stay dry for daylight hours with spells of bright winter sunshine, northwest winds will be brisk, bringing an added wind chill factor. Few coastal showers too though, mainly in the north and northwest, with highest temperatures tomorrow of only 4 to 7 degrees. Now, tomorrow Friday night will bring scattered wintry showers with temporary sleet and snow possible on lower levels of the north and east, and possibly the first dusting of snow on the mountains here. Looking ahead then to the weekend, well, temperatures will remain well below normal with northerly breezes persisting and further frost and ice. Overall, we're looking at a lot of dry weather, generally speaking, through the weekend, again, with some nice bright winter sunshine, but there will be a few wintry showers out there too, with northern and eastern coastal counties most at threat. Today then, in brief, well, a bitterly cold day to come with widespread heavy showers early on, some of those possibly turning wintry. Showers then will become confined to Atlantic counties with spells of winter sunshine gradually developing elsewhere. Highest temperatures today of only 2 to 5 degrees in light to moderate westerly breezes. That's it from me. A very good morning.
Good morning. It's just after 8 o'clock and you're listening to Morning Ireland with Áine Lawler and Rachel English. With the news now, here's Brian Jennings.
A report commissioned by government has recommended widespread legislative changes and greater powers and resources to be given to the Gardaí and other agencies investigating corruption, fraud and economic crime. The Hamilton Review says there would be a longer period of detention to allow for the questioning of suspects, and that amended legislation is needed to deal with ethics breaches by former Oireachtas members. The Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, said her plan to implement the report's recommendations would require collaboration across government, cabinet and state agencies. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
As a major international hub for financial services, with Irish-based companies administering funds of approximately €1.8 trillion, Ireland's exposure to economic crime, especially fraud, is, this report says, substantial. The Hamilton Review makes 25 legislative, policing, structural and prosecutorial changes to tackle so-called white-collar crime. Gardaí, it says, should have search warrants to allow them to demand the passwords for phones, computers and other electronic devices. Independent experts should be allowed to sit in when suspects are being interviewed, and detention periods should be extended for up to 7 days, similar to organised crime offences. The report also recommends the government should move quicker to amend ethics legislation in the case of former members of the Oireachtas, and says bid rigging, nepotism and the improper use of influence when hiring public officials should be considered criminal offences.
The Taoiseach Micheál Martin has told a meeting of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party that nursing home residents, the elderly and frontline health workers will be prioritised for vaccinations against COVID-19, which he said will be delivered across the country free of charge. Mr Martin also said that he did not envisage that sectors such as retail that have reopened after the lifting of level 5 restrictions would have to close again. Here's Mary Regan of our political staff.
After months of bad news last night, the leaders of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael gave rare upbeat assessments to their respective parliamentary parties. The Taoiseach told a private Fianna Fáil meeting that there is light at the end of the tunnel and that 2021 will be a different year as we emerge from COVID-19. He said vaccines will be administered free of charge to people across the country and healthcare workers, the elderly and nursing home residents will be prioritised in a sequenced programme. Some TDs raised fears about a return to lockdown in January, while others voiced concerns about continuing pub closures, particularly in rural areas. But Mr Martin said there is broad public support for the lifting of Level 5 restrictions and that people need a respite and a break. He said that sectors that have reopened may not be closed again. Meanwhile, the Taoiseach told a Fine Gael meeting that he was reasonably confident that a COVID-19 vaccine would start to be rolled out in January. Widespread population immunity would be achieved by next September or October, he said, but the vaccination will have a meaningful impact well before then. Leo Varadkar also told the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party that a communications campaign is vital to overcome vaccine hesitancy.
The rollout of a vaccination programme for coronavirus will be discussed by the National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, at a meeting later today. Ireland now has the lowest 14-day incidence of infection in the European Union. However, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, has said there's no room for complacency. He has appealed to people to use basic public health advice as a guide and to avoid high-risk situations when organising their time as more services reopen for businesses. Our environment and science correspondent, George Lee.
Key unknowns about the development of a COVID-19 vaccination strategy for Ireland were laid out in a new overview publication by the European Centre for Disease Control last evening. It drew on a survey of all EU countries about their vaccination plans in November. Only two countries failed to answer that survey, and Ireland was one of them. So key questions in the ECDC report remain. Will existing vaccination structures and delivery services be adequate for the biggest vaccination programme ever? Will Ireland need to train more people to carry out vaccinations, or perhaps copy countries like Germany and France that are reactivating retired doctors to help? Do we have an appropriate electronic immunisation registry system, or how else might Ireland monitor and document the coverage, safety, effectiveness and acceptance of a vaccine? The National Public Health Emergency Team will be meeting later today. Questions like these and many more will be on the agenda.
More than 1,200 people have been given help to secure a home of their own this year with the support of the Peter McVerry Trust. This represents a 50% increase on the figure for last year. A former president of France, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, has died. He was 94. He was president of France from 1974 to 1981 and was a key architect of European integration. President Emmanuel Macron said his predecessor had transformed France during his 7 years in the Élysée, legalising abortion, liberalising the divorce laws and lowering the voting age to 18. Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
It'll be bitterly cold. Early on, there'll be widespread heavy showers, some of which will be wintry. The showers will become confined to Atlantic coastal counties and there'll be spells of winter sunshine. Highest temperatures will range from 2 to 5 degrees.
Vaccine to be free as rollout plans get go-ahead is the front page headline on the Irish Examiner this morning. Above detail of the story that as the country prepares to start vaccinations next month, Taoiseach Micheál Martin has said the jabs will be free. The paper writes that the Taoiseach told last night's meeting of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party that the vaccines will be made available in a sequence with priority given to healthcare workers, the elderly and nursing homes. The front page of the Irish News has the story that 7 COVID-19 vaccination centres are to open in Northern Ireland, which will be receiving 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, 25,000 of which are due to arrive next week. The Irish Times also leads with news of Ireland's vaccine plan, detailing how the government will decide next week on the priority vaccination groups, with the elderly, high-risk patients, healthcare staff, nursing home residents and staff, other frontline workers and meat plant workers all likely to be among the first recipients. And on page 3 of that paper, Paul Cullen has a helpful explainer panel, which addresses many of the questions that are on everybody's lips, including, can we get back to normal soon? Not quite, he writes. It takes a month after the first of the two doses before Pfizer's jab is effective. The process of rolling out the vaccine to most of the population will take much of 2021. Still, though, the vaccine story brought out the best in the tabloid headline writers this morning. The Irish Daily Star has fun rebranding the traditional Christmas Coca-Cola truck as Pfizer for its front page, alongside the words Jolly Days Are Coming, while the Irish Sun leads on Vac to the Future. EU warns UK time running out for Brexit deal is the headline over Naomi O'Leary's story on the front page of the Irish Times that the European Union has told Britain there must be a breakthrough by tomorrow or there may be no way to avoid massive disruption on the 1st of January. She writes that the two sides are locked in intense talks to try to avoid a sudden imposition of tariffs on trade that would devastate Irish exporters in just a few weeks' time. Surge in house prices to be fuelled by pandemic savings is the main front page story for the Irish Independent this morning, above Senan Maloney and Gareth Morgan's piece, which says that property prices are set to rise further since prospective buyers have been able to save more during the pandemic, with Irish people now holding €123 billion on deposit. On page 1 of The Examiner, Daniel McConnell takes up the story that a new government report today will suggest that consideration should be given to making nepotism a criminal offence, but not for politicians who appoint family members to roles in offices. A spokesman for the Department of Justice said the reference to nepotism falls within the general understanding of conflicts of interest and would include preferential treatment of a person based on identity for positions or in the awarding of contracts. The review group was not necessarily considering the appointment of family members by TDs and senators. Finally, in the Irish Daily Mail, Evine Bryant writes of the popularity of Irish names among pandemic babies born in the UK this year. The normal people effect is still going strong, with the name Connell appearing for the first time on a new list of most popular baby names in Britain. Similarly, the name Vogue, as in the Irish influencer Vogue Williams, also features, but it doesn't end there. The name Niamh appears on the list for the first time, squeaking in at 100th place.
Morning Ireland, it's 13 minutes past 8. And if you think back, a year ago, the world had never heard of COVID-19, but the first cases were already emerging. Yesterday morning, the first approval was given in the UK for a vaccine against the virus that has raged across the world in the past 12 months. And our reporter Joan O'Sullivan is out meeting commuters in Dublin this morning to hear what they make of these remarkable developments. Joan, tell us where you are and what people have been telling you.
Anya, I'm outside of Houston Station and I've been talking to people this morning about a COVID-19 vaccine, something that we've been speaking about since the start of the pandemic and which at one stage we were told could take several years to develop. Now it's gone from being a possibility to a reality, with people in Northern Ireland receiving it as early as next week and people here in the Republic possibly being able to receive it in January. So I've been speaking to people here and asking them what they think about that. I have to say most people were thrilled and delighted and relieved that a vaccine is going to be here soon, though some were expressing concerns about the speed at which it's been developed. Let's have a listen to them now.
Well, I think it's great, especially for the vulnerable and for the elderly. So if it comes out, you know, they should all get it first and hopefully most people will take it, hopefully.
Would you be concerned that some people would be reluctant?
Definitely, especially when something is new out, and especially with vaccines, and people are saying a lot of things about other vaccines from the past and side effects and stuff like that. So I can see where people are coming from that, but I think this is unprecedented, everything that's happened. So I'm hoping people will take it when it comes out, yeah.
I think it's great, to be honest. I will definitely go for the vaccine. I'll be one of the first people to get it because it gives us all a bit of a sense of peace. I've had to take another job. My job hasn't opened since March. I had to get another job and I'm there full time now. So it's a big change for me, but I'll definitely be one of the first to take the vaccine anyway.
I'm a bit nervous, to be honest. And I'm a frontline worker and I feel like it's the frontline workers who would have to take it first. But you know, like, I suppose I'm hoping it's not going to be imposed, but I'm guessing that it would most likely be, you know, in conjunction with your work. They might say, oh, if you don't take it, then it might affect your work. So I suppose I'm apprehensive, but look, we don't know. We're just going to wait and see how it goes.
Some interesting reactions there from commuters in Dublin City Centre this morning, talking to our reporter Joan O'Sullivan. And joining us now is Dr. Mary Favier, who's a GP in Cork City, as you know, COVID-19 advisor to the Irish College of General Practitioners as well. Dr. Mary Favier, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
What did you make of those reactions from people? Obviously, there's a broad welcome, but some concerns as well. Communication is going to be key here, isn't it?
I think the reactions are as expected. You can hear the emotion in people's voices, because it's been such a big and difficult year in so many different ways, and the challenges have been, you know, everything from health through to employment, as we've heard there. And communication will be really important because there's a lot of interest in a vaccine, understandably. There's a lot of enthusiasm, mm-hmm. but there's understandable cautions and there's some anxiety. And I think it will behove many of us who are in the health area to listen to these anxieties, you know, explore what they're about and try to answer them as honestly and as fairly as we can. Because we need a very significant uptake of this vaccine to make it work. It's estimated we need about 60% of the population, you know, to take the vaccine to actually get what's called herd immunity, so that vulnerable people who for any reason don't have it or can't have it will get coverage. And that's going to be a really significant logistic challenge. But what we can do.
How important will GP surgeries? I mean, we're hearing things about the supply chains. We know some of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine that needs to be stored at -79, Moderna, I think, at -20. Will GP surgeries be able to cope with the logistics of that kind of cold storage?
I think the involvement of general practitioners in the vaccination program hasn't been decided yet, because we don't want to preempt the decisions of the National Implementation Committee that will report next mm-hmm. week. But there is potentially a role for general practice, not necessarily with the fridges that need the very cold temperatures. But in the general practitioners are very good at rolling out immunization programs, and we've done it with all the baby vaccines. We do it with flu vaccine every year. We've done it with the new children's flu vaccine this year, because we have the patient base, we have the IT systems, we have the computers, and we generally know our patients very well, and we're nimble and can respond. And as many GPs this year, for instance, gave the vaccines on Saturdays and after hours to try and get it across the line. However, the other side of that is GPs have been really, really overworked. And like every other healthcare worker, the idea of taking on another task is like, oh dear, can it pass me by? However, like all the other healthcare workers, they will potentially stand up to the plate. And the likely phasing of the vaccine, and again, we don't want to preempt decisions, is, as has been well discussed, those to residential care facilities, those who are most vulnerable, older age groups, frontline healthcare workers who have patient-facing roles, and then a rollout to the broader population. Where general practitioners will be vital is determining who are the people who have other illnesses and comorbidities, and to identify those and to make sure that people get not just one dose, but two doses. People need to remember that there's two doses at the moment, 3 weeks apart, and you don't get immunity then for another week after that. So it's a full 4 weeks. And the first dose is largely useless if you don't have the second one. So it's really important that people engage with that idea. And there are big challenges in it. Not just, I mean, as has been said many times before, a vaccine doesn't save lives, but vaccination does. Mm-hmm. And so we need to organize it from not just the production of the vaccine, but the needles and syringes and the tables and the halls and the how you get it there, how the IT system.
And it's not even that. Yet. Well, that actually is the key thing, isn't it? That the Taoiseach was raising at the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting last night. We don't have a national, you know, centralised database for keeping track of everybody. But there will need to be an IT system to keep track of who's got the vaccine, who's got the second dose of the vaccine. Again, people will be wondering, do you need vaccine passports? The issues of fraud that Dr. Margaret Harris from the WHO was talking about earlier. These are critical questions, aren't they?
They're critical questions, and we don't want any particular part of the chain to fail. Now, GPs have very good IT systems, so you know we can support where that is. But the issue of a COVID passport is a very important one, the validity of that. And so we don't want to rush this. It needs to be done well. There's very substantial planning has gone into it. But each part will need to function, and functionality is going to be a very significant issue. But general practitioners will be prepared to participate. The thing we need to remember, though, as a society, that this is still some way off. We need to focus on what's happening now in front of us. It's like a marathon. It's like we've seen the end, but we still have the last 4 or 5 miles to go. We're effectively, in one way, hitting the wall of Christmas. And it's to remind people that this is their opportunity to stay safe until the vaccine arrives.
You haven't run the race just because you can see the stadium. One final question, Mary Favier, and it was interesting in Joan's Vox Pop there, the woman who said that she was a health worker, but she had concerns that maybe, you know, she'd be made take the vaccine on account of her job. What do you say about healthcare workers and this question of vaccination uptake?
I think we should reassure her. We have never undertaken mandatory vaccination in this country, and I think we'd be very slow to get there, but there will be national immunisation guidance formulated on that. But I think as a society, we've always attempted to be cooperative. We've always attempted to do things together, and I think the same will continue to apply. And potentially into employment scenarios where people can't be forced to have the vaccine so that they can be employed. But you can see how many employees and all types of people will really want to encourage their staff to have vaccine because it'll make a safer place for everybody. And that's people who run dance classes and run gyms and open theatres and bar owners.
And airlines?
All of us.
Sorry? Airlines? What about airlines insisting
airlines,
on vaccination
passports? There will be great encouragement to get vaccination. And I see people will be rushing to get it in some cases, and others will be hesitant. So rushing to get it might be because you want to go on your sun holiday. However, there will have to be ways of structuring an orderly queue effectively. And then when we do it properly.
Dr. Mary Favier, GP in Cork City, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on Morning Ireland this morning.
A report published this morning recommends a thorough overhaul of the way the state investigates corruption, fraud and economic crime. The review, led by the former Director of Public Prosecutions, James Hamilton, highlights a litany of shortcomings, including a lack of staff and funding. It also calls for new powers for Gardaí and for ethics legislation to be strengthened and reformed. In response, the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, has promised a new policy on white-collar crime. James Hamilton joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
There has long been a perception that when it comes to white-collar crime or economic crime in this country, that the state's approach is just not robust enough. And your report seems to bear that out.
Well, I think one of the problems which happened was when we got hit by the economic crisis back in 2008, resources were very scarce. And you have to imagine, if you were the commissioner of the Garda Síochána, you still have to solve the murders and the rapes and crimes like that. And I'm afraid what happened was that white-collar crime, along with other things, got a bit of a backseat, with the result that we actually had a situation where the fraud squad back in 1991 or 2 had more resources than the Garda National Bureau of Economic Crime had until recently. This is, I believe, being addressed at the moment, and there is quite a programme of recruitment taking place. So even in advance of publication of this report, there are actions being taken, I understand.
And that appears, reading through your report, this staffing issue appears to be one of the fundamental issues. As you said to yourself there, it does seem extraordinary that there should have been more Gardaí devoted to these issues 30 years ago than there were in recent times.
Well, I can't really comment on the internal matters of the Garda Síochána. I was a prosecutor, not a policeman. And I have to say as well, some of the agencies that deal with these problems are quite well-resourced. Central Bank, for example, the Corporate Crime Bureau. So, in a way, I suppose what happens sometimes is there's a crisis in an agency and then something is done to beef up the resources, whereas an agency that manages to trundle along and just cope gets neglected. So I'm afraid that's part of life, but we've recommended anyway that these shortcomings should be addressed.
You also say that there should be additional specialist prosecutors. At the moment, is there a lack of expertise in that area?
I wouldn't put it like that. The DPP's office have in fact set up a unit within their office to do this, but it's a very small unit and it certainly needs additional resources. I look at it this way. This isn't just some sort of academic problem. We're talking here, any of us who've been using computers in the last 6 months or so, and an awful lot more people have been buying things online and so on. We're all very familiar with the number of scams that we see and bogus websites and people wanting to click on things and people's savings disappearing in an instant. So this is a major problem that affects all citizens. We also now have the headquarters of many important international firms based in this country. We have a serious financial services sector. And what worries me is that we could have some problem like the Nick Leeson one that happened some years ago, where huge sums of money were stolen from Barings Bank. And we need to be able to investigate and deal with crimes of that sort if they happen. We hope they don't, but we need to be ready if they do. And where there's big money, then there will be criminals.
Something else the review calls for is the reform and strengthening of ethics and public office legislation. As you see it, what's the main problem at the moment?
Well, one of the problems was we had a public sector standards bill 2015, which sat during the last Dáil and never got passed, and which again was going to strengthen the ethics regime to extend it to people that it doesn't extend to. To ensure, for example, that former TDs who are subject to it while they're TDs, but then the minute they cease to be, the ethics in public office, the standards in public office people don't have any power to deal with the matter. So that's a big gap, for instance.
Another recommendation that caught my eye, you say there's a need for stronger laws when it comes to public sector ethics, including perhaps the creation of new offences such as nepotism in the hiring of public officials and the improper use of influence. What sort of things are you concerned about?
Well, what I'm thinking about is this. I suppose people have a notion that the normal type of corruption we think about is a payment of a bribe, but in the real world, I'm not sure that things always work like that. And there are very often situations where people, they're asked to do a favour for somebody, and they do it, and maybe no money changes hands, but then the expectation is that the favour will be returned in some way. So it's very important that we have a situation where, for instance, when applying for jobs or anything of that sort, or when dealing with public authorities, that all citizens are treated equally. And that doesn't run alongside the idea that you favour people because of who their relations are, who their friends are. They happen to have a bit of influence because they know somebody who's important in a public institution. So it's quite important that we don't allow things like that to dominate the way business is transacted.
Looking at this entire area of economic or white-collar crime, why do you think that it has been the poor cousin in many ways? Is it that the authorities don't treat crime by men and women in suits as seriously as other crime, even though the consequences can be so profound and far-reaching?
I think that probably has been the case in the past, but I think people are starting to realise that this is something that affects us all. And I think, for instance, there's a much greater appreciation that, when that it's a drain on the public purse when, for example, there's corruption and when the state pays too much for a contract, for example, because there's a corrupt way that it's awarded. All of these sort of things. And that's one of the reasons, for example, why we have recommended that there should be an overall body, not a large body, but an advisory council that would have, for example, a national plan and would ensure that there are things like publicity campaigns explaining to people the problems about corruption, the problems about fraud and so forth.
Do you believe
that's been lacking until now because we have a number of different agencies who all do their own thing, and many of them do it very well. But we haven't had an overall approach to things.
Do you believe that there will be change? Because this is a problem that's been highlighted for pretty much as long as I can remember.
Well, I'm not a politician, and so I can't promise anything or tell you whether there will or won't. I do know there was a commitment in the programme for government to increase the Garda resources in this area, and I do know that's happening at the moment. I hope it continues to happen. I know the Minister for Justice will be speaking later this morning on another RTE programme, and no doubt she'll explain what the plans are. So there certainly are signs of willingness to engage, but you know, I can't make any promise or give any undertaking. I'm a retired public servant. I'm not a member of the political class.
James Hamilton, thank you very much indeed for taking our call this morning. It's 8:31.
And now Jill Steadman has the business headlines.
Thanks, Áine. Boots has become the first pharmacy in Ireland to offer a COVID-19 testing service in store. The service is only available to customers without symptoms. Testing will be available from tomorrow across 7 stores. Potential homebuyers have largely been unaffected by the economic impact of COVID-19, according to a new survey by myhome.ie. It found that 58% have been able to save more money for a deposit since March. However, just 22% expect prices to drop by more than 5% next year. That figure was at 68% in May. Total business activity in Ireland's services sector economy fell at a faster rate in November than the previous month. That's according to the latest AIB PMI. Other indicators were more promising. New business declined only slightly, while the outlook for activity in 2021 strengthened amid vaccine hopes. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 90.5 pence sterling and $1 21.2 cents.
9:23, you're listening to Morning Ireland. Des is here with the sports news.
Yeah, hi Áine. It was a busy night in football last night. In the Champions League, Brazilian star Neymar scored twice as Paris Saint-Germain beat Manchester United 3-1 at Old Trafford. Neymar put PSG ahead after 6 minutes. United did draw level before half-time through Marcus Rashford, but the French side grabbed the win when Marquinhos poked home a goal in the 69th minute and Neymar added the third in stoppage time. United's problems, though, intensified when their midfielder Fred was sent off for a second yellow card with 20 minutes left. Now, the group couldn't be tighter with one game remaining. United, PSG and Red Bull Leipzig, they're all on 9 points going into that final game. Leipzig were 4-3 winners in Istanbul. The United manager, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, was asked about Fred's red card and if he should have been substituted given his first yellow was for putting his head into an opponent's face.
Fred shouldn't put his head towards him. I don't think he touched him, but still you don't do that. So he's a bit lucky. Yeah, it's either nothing or a red card.
And he got a yellow. It was a strange.
Yeah, but, you know, I thought maybe it was a bit lucky to stay on when the referee decided to give him anything.
Did you think take him off at half time because of that?
Yeah, and maybe. But Fred has played really well, and he played really well. We spoke about staying calm, staying on your feet, and the second yellow card is nowhere near a foul. So Ander knows that as well. He definitely knows.
Elsewhere, striker Olivier Giroud scored 4 goals as a dominant Chelsea won 4-0 at Seville to secure top spot in their group with a match to spare. Here's the Chelsea manager, Frank Lampard.
4 goals at this level, and actually the quality of the goals. Individual aspects from Ollie himself, team aspects in the first goal in particular, played from back to front. Amazing solo performance from him. He deserves all the accolades. I'm delighted with him. I'm delighted with the team to come here against a very strong Seville team. They made changes, so did we. It's a difficult place to come, and the team performance from start to finish was great because it had everything. There were moments in the first time where it was tough, first half where it was tough for us. And we dealt with those moments, and then our play was just brilliant.
In other games, Dortmund and Lazio drew 1-1. Barcelona were 3-0 winners at Ferencvaros, and Juventus forward Cristiano Ronaldo scored the 750th goal of his remarkable career in a 3-0 win over Dynamo Kiev. This was a game where Stephanie Frappart of France became the first female referee to take charge of a Champions League match. Now, tonight, Dundalk manager Filippo Giovannoli will pick the team for the Europa League game against Molde in Norway, despite being banned from acting as a head coach of the game. He does not possess the relevant coaching qualifications, and Dundalk were issued with a €50,000 fine as a result of Giovannoli shadow coaching in the early games of the group stages. So Shane Keegan will manage the sideline, and he's been talking about the strength of tonight's opposition.
They're arguably in a lot better form this time round than they were coming into the previous one. They'd had a couple of iffy results heading into the last one, whereas I think I'm right in saying they've won 5 and drawn 1 in the 6 games, league games they've played since we last came up against them. So they're really, really banging form. They seem to have kind of pretty much nailed down that second position. So it will be a very, very tough one, that's for sure. But, I mean, we have to take heart from probably two-thirds of our performance against them in the home game. I thought we were probably the better side in the first half and deservedly had that lead. Now, to be fair to them, you know, when they really turned the screw on us, we probably couldn't get out of our own half, couldn't get out of our own third, really, to be honest with you, for about 20-25 minutes of that second half. But then came right back into it again. I think most people would agree that we were probably, you know, right to be scratching our heads as to how we came out of that game without something to show from it. And to be honest, you know, when you're competing against teams like Molde and against and like Rapid, who are firm favourites, you know, in every respect, financially, you know, in quality wise, all those kinds of things, the fact that we have gone toe to toe with them does give you huge confidence. And any question marks we had over whether we thought we were good enough to mix with them before the first game, I think those question marks are removed at this stage. And look, you have to respect them, they're a serious side, but at the same time we have to fully believe that we can go and do something.
That's Shane Keegan. Now, spectators returned to some sporting events in Britain last night's football.
Crying?
Well, I was jealous. Carlisle, in the lowest division, they scored a goal against Salford in League Two, and the joy I got from hearing the roar of 2,000 fans on the ground, it was fantastic. It really was the difference between it and the fall sound we hear. So it's something for us all to look forward to. In rugby, Andy Farrell will this afternoon name the Irish team to play Scotland on Saturday. It's expected Johnny Sexton and Robbie Henshaw will both return. Michael Corcoran has been speaking to Irish forward Ian Henderson about the areas where Ireland will seek to improve.
I'd definitely say we're looking to improve in some things. There's a lot of things at the weekend I think we did really well. It'll be obviously a completely different side we play. Tactically, physically, I think Scotland are going to definitely look to come at us. They've been preparing for this game for a while now, so they'll have their tactics and plans in place, and it's up to us with the short turnaround to get on top of what we need to get on top of, get all our detail under the belt, which I think most of it's done now. And today at training, put it into practice, test ourselves today, and then we'll roll into the weekend and see how we go.
Ian Henderson. In Gaelic games, Owen Elliott of Antrim has been named as referee for the All-Ireland Senior Camogie Final between Galway and Kilkenny on Saturday week. And finally for now, Rachel, racing action today is in Clonmel and it gets underway at 12:30.
Well, as we heard earlier from Tony Connolly, talks on a new post-Brexit trade deal remain deadlocked over future fishing rights. That's one of the chief issues causing that blockage at the moment. We're going to talk now to Patrick Murphy, who's the chief executive of the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation. Thanks for joining us this morning. From what you've been hearing in recent days, what's your reaction to what's happening at these talks?
Good morning, Rachel, and good morning to the listeners. Yeah, we had always ascertained that the same share and same access would maintain regardless of Brexit. Otherwise, we would see huge complications in the industry. And we asked for all negotiations to be linked to trade. That now has deemed to be thrown away. We understand that Michel Barnier has given a different mandate to offer more fish to the UK. And this completely destroys, as we feel, relative stability going forward. So it changes the whole rules according to the Common Fishery Policy. And we feel the Irish fishing fleet are going to be the most adversely affected through this.
Realistically, how much power does Ireland have in all of this at the moment?
Well, look, we're going to be an outermost region after Brexit. We're going to be cut off by land, sea and air. And our fishing communities have been decimated in recent years. And the common fishery policy has been good to most, but not really to the Irish fleet. We've seen in the last decade alone a reduction of 42% in our fishing fleet from vessels over 18 metres. And as a person who grew up in Baltimore and fished from Baltimore, I've seen it being wiped out, Rachel, in front of my eyes in a very few short years. So we had 30 boats there when I started. They were down to 5 or 6 now. So if this continues, we just won't have a fishing fleet. So that's what it'll mean for Ireland. We will lose our fishing fleet. And that's not a joke. This is reality because it's been happening over the last decade and it's going to continue. We will have boats, if they're told to get out of the UK waters, to go somewhere else. And we are where the fish are. You know, contrary to what people say, Ireland is a place where there's a lots of fish. That's why a lot of boats come to our area. But it can only sustain so many boats. So if too many come to the area, all the work of the common fishery policy for the 40 years past could be undone. And for us, this should be looked at and looked at seriously. So we need to put in safety measures. How many boats will be allowed to come into Irish waters if they're put out of UK waters? What will be the access share? Will our fleet be expected to take less and give more to other fleets? So will our fleets have to reduce the numbers again dramatically to allow other fleets to come in and fish in our waters? And we as an industry find that incredible that we haven't been spoken to and discussed this part of the negotiations. You know, we're in the dark.
All right. Patrick Murphy, thanks so much for taking our call this morning.
And an issue very much on the table at those talks in London, and even at this late stage, not clear what Boris Johnson is going to do about the Brexit deal. Pressure coming on from Europe to Michel Barnier as well. George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times. George, you're writing today that without a change in the UK position, a deal this weekend's impossible.
Well, certainly Michel Barnier has reported back to the member states about the progress in the talks, and he's been told by President Macron of France and some other European leaders, particularly those with coastal borders onto the English Channel and the North Sea, that he needs to get a better deal, particularly on the issue of fishing that you were just talking about. And so the talks dragged on late into last night. There was a scene at about 10 o'clock last night of pizzas being delivered to what they call the cave, this underground negotiating room where Michel Barnier and David Frost, his British counterpart, have been leading the negotiations. But things are getting very, very close. I still think actually there's enough room for manoeuvre here that both sides will be able to get to an agreement, and people in London at least talking about the possibility of a deal by the weekend.
But there's also, and Boris Johnson faced a bit of a backbench revolt over COVID restrictions this week, that vote. There's also Eurosceptic Tory MPs, their fears that there'll be betrayal, there'll be a case of sellout on Brexit. How much will that weigh with him?
Well, that will weigh very heavily on Boris Johnson, but in a way, these are the two extremes in the argument, aren't they, really? You've got the Tory Eurosceptics who think that any concession to Brussels is a betrayal of national sovereignty. And on the other side, pushing Michel Barnier, you've got people like President Macron who want to maintain a very big share of the fish in British territorial waters. And so those are the big sort of two things that are basically hanging in the balance, really. It's sort of fish versus sovereignty. And, you know, both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Macron face their own political pressures at home. But nevertheless, I still think that we are getting into a sort of landing zone area. And there's going to have to be a big bust-up, of course. There always is at the end of a negotiation. But my sense is we're getting closer.
We'll wait and see. It's been a long time, George. Thank you very much indeed. George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times. It's 11 minutes to 9.
Irish embassies play an important role in bringing messages from this country to key figures around the world. And this year, one of those key figures happens to be Santa Claus. Ireland's ambassador to Finland, Ruth Parkin, spoke yesterday to Santa, who's currently working hard in Lapland in the Arctic Circle. They had a conversation via Zoom, and he had this message of reassurance for children who might be slightly worried about his ability to travel this Christmas.
Don't worry. I will be able to travel. And I just read it from here. I am an essential worker, after all, and that's lovely. I have my Christmas magic, of course, and I understand I have some special diplomatic arrangements also, and thank you for that. Please tell the children I'll be there.
And that was Santa speaking yesterday to Ruth Parkin, who joins us now on the line. Ambassador, what else did Santa tell you?
Good morning, Rachel. It's lovely to join you this morning. And it was really wonderful to speak to Santa yesterday. Santa's really excited to get lots of messages this year, like he is every year. And the post is working, but it's a little bit slow sometimes, as we all know. So he really wants to hear from people. And he's really interested also to get children's best ideas for tackling climate change. He experiences that up in the Arctic Circle already. The snow is there, but is a little bit late this year.
And if children then, if they would like you to pass on a message to Santa, because after all, he's not that far away from you, what should they do?
All they need to do is ask the parents to help them and go to the tobeirish.ie website, which was launched by Minister Brophy earlier in the week and is collecting lots of ideas from around the world of how the Irish celebrate Christmas. But it has a special Dear Santa page. You can upload your pictures and your ideas. You can answer the questions, send them to us. And we are going to make sure that either through diplomatic channels or by direct delivery, we will have them to Santa well before Christmas. And Santa has also told us that he's going to read some of those messages and give us some responses.
Yeah, I know some children have been a little worried over the past few weeks because of the fact that Santa is old. You know, they're worried that he could get sick, but it seems he's in great form.
He was in wonderful form yesterday. He's a bit sad that he can't have as many visitors this year. Usually lots of visitors come to Lapland in December, but it's a bit quieter in terms of international travel. But what he is really looking forward to is getting travelling on Christmas Eve. He's really delighted that Minister Coveney was able to give him the diplomatic clearance and that he confirmed that in the Dáil. He's also got his magic and he is going to be there on Christmas Eve.
And if the vaccine is available soon, is he likely to get it just to be on the safe side?
Well, as we heard, Santa is an essential worker. And in Finland, like in the rest of Europe, we're waiting for the confirmation from the European Medicines Agency that the vaccine's been approved. And essential workers will be top of the list. So I'm sure Santa will be first in line. It's also really important that we keep on going with our social distancing, even when the vaccine starts, because we know it won't work very well until everyone's got it or a lot of people have got it. So that's why it's still really important for the children to stay in bed and let Santa Claus come in and do his job in peace.
Mm, and just overall then, the key message that Santa wants to pass on is this, that if you have been a little worried about him, there's just no need to be concerned. He'll be there, usual time, usual place.
Absolutely. And we in the embassy in Finland are delighted to help bring this message. We don't usually have to open diplomatic channels like this, but we know it's been a special year and a hard year. And we wanted to make sure that Santa's message was able to reach all the children that are worried about Christmas this year. And we know that it's going to be a good Christmas, even if it's a little bit different.
Ambassador Ruth Parkin, thank you so much for joining us this morning and have a happy Christmas. I think that's the first time I've wished somebody a happy Christmas this year. It's 8:54.
Well, here's something to ponder. If you were playing the lotto and the consecutive numbers 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 were drawn, and then a Powerball number of 10, well, would you think that was too good to be true? Well, that's, it seems, is what happened in the South African lotto draw last night. To tell us more, Bill Corcoran, a journalist based in Cape Town. That's way better than anything Santa Claus would ever bring, that sequence of numbers, isn't it, Bill Corcoran?
It certainly is, and there were 20 lucky winners who will be having a very nice Christmas who chose those numbers 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and the Powerball number of 10. They each take home with them the round equivalent of about €305,000. So that will put a smile on many people's faces. And then another 79 people actually picked the numbers 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and then missed the Powerball number. So it is actually quite an amazing sequence of numbers to come up. But not impossible. Apparently, according to the National Lotteries Commission, there's a 1 in 42 million chance of getting that sequence of numbers. But they also said that they are increasingly seeing people pick sequences of numbers like that. So maybe it's not as surprising as we all expect. But saying that, South Africans are primed to expect corruption in every walk of life at the moment. There's a number of public sector corruption inquiries underway. So it wasn't surprising to see social media and radio stations erupt with allegations of corruption and fraud. The Lottery Commission has quick to step in and say that they will conduct an inquiry into it just to make sure that everything is above board. But the numbers were drawn on live TV, so we hope that that is the case, that it's all fair and above board, and these people are just lucky.
How big an issue has this been? How big a story has this been overnight there?
Well, it's a pretty big story. People have taken to social media in large numbers to question whether this could actually happen. And if you
listen, they're all saying
it's too
good to be true, is that right?
They're saying it's too good to be true and that there must be some sort of corruption or fraud or scam underway. As I said, unfortunately, here in South Africa, public sector corruption is a big issue, and there are news stories coming out on a daily basis of people in government who were involved in scams of one form or another. So people, it's on people's mind all the time, so it's not surprising that they would jump to that conclusion.
Well, 1 in 42 million chance it really does happen, or it has happened anyway, and it's being investigated. Bill Corcoran, journalist in Cape Town in South Africa. Thank you very much indeed. My editor, of course, has reminded me no evidence either way. So that is the story there. Let's take a break at 3 minutes to 9.